Today is June 14th. It's Flag Day. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original Personal Computer Radio Show, and I'm Hank Key, and in the studio with me is my colleague, Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, pcradioshow.org. When WBAI is fundraising, we may be preempted by a replacement program, but we continue with a regularly scheduled weekly program on PRN.FM.
Well, Hank, on July 12th, we're going to have a special one-hour program with Dr. Alfred Poor and Dan Rosenbaum. He's the publisher of Health Insider, and they're going to talk about the convergence of technology and health matters. But I'd like to make note that it was on July 12th, 1957, the Surgeon General announced that cigarette smoking could kill you. Jesus, they could kill you. I wish he had said it 5 years earlier, and I never would have started smoking in the first place. Well, I got to tell you, I eventually did stop. But Hank, very often WBAI runs a fundraising drive, and they fail to pick up this show, the Personal Computer Show, from PRN-FM. Nevertheless, I'd like to tell the folks that they can always hear the Personal Computer Show, the regular weekly show, on PRN at 6 p.m. on Wednesdays. Doesn't matter what BAI does. We're always here.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that we've been, or at least I've been railing at, is that the Chromebook that came out of, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, the concept was good. In other words, to me, the biggest asset was if anything happens to the computer, you just do a factory reset and just bring it back to its original condition, no fuss, no muss. And one of the problems that you had, Joe, with it is that everything had to go through the cloud, and you're not a big fan of cloud computing. But you know what? For the schools, you could do, you know, that's not going to go down at all. And you could do a lot of the stuff with it. And I find that, by the way, talking to a lot of people working in corporate America, the thin client is a big deal now, where they just want to minimize the actual work done on the computer, and they're into thin clients. But the biggest problem I've had with Chrome OS, of course, is printing. And, you know, when you ask Google about it, oh, you just do cloud printing. Go to, you know, do the Google cloud printing. And I know I've once asked you, Joe, have you tried configuring it?
Well, as a matter of fact, Hank, you did ask me that, and I hadn't configured it at that point, so I went out and did just that. I configured my brother-in-law's printer for him as a Google Cloud printer. And I can think of better ways to spend a whole weekend.
Well, Google announced that they now have come up with where you don't have to go to the cloud to print anymore. And I said, wow, I better look into this. And I spoke to our webmaster, Michael Horowitz, who's also into, you know, with the Chromebook, and he likes it. But, you know, as we examine it more, if you read it very carefully, I said, wait a minute now. If you want to do printing and you want to use your existing printer, is it possible? And the fine print says that it relies on that you have to have a printer IP address. And I said to myself, wait a minute, a printer IP address means a network printer. Okay, I can do that. I have a network printer. And once you have a network printer, you have the IP address. And, of course, how many people know what the IP address is? Well, there are utilities to do that. Now you're saying, now you add another level of non-simplicity. And then if you have a regular printer, I said to Michael, you know what? I could buy an adapter that take a regular printer and make it a network printer. Now you add another level to it, and I know you, Joe, said to me, that's not solving the problem.
Well, it's solving the problem, but, Hank, it's a different kind of solution. I know a young woman of age 97. Hank knows her as well, and
she can do it.
I often ask him, well, with those instructions, could Irene do it? And in this case, the answer, I think, is no. First of all, Hank, you knew what an IPP was.
Mm-hmm.
You knew it was a printer protocol for the Internet, so why isn't it a PPI? The whole thing is set up for geeks. Michael Horowitz, our webmaster, wrote me a very short note about this when you told him about this, and he, three words, it's for geeks.
Well, let's put it this way. Google does not ever have a schedule for anything on things like release dates. Everything starts off as beta. You don't know when the beta becomes officially a non-beta. And I just hope that they realize that they should spend a little effort on this Chromebooks, and then the Chromebooks will take off because as much as I don't believe, not that I don't believe in it, okay, but if I can do it locally, I'd rather do it locally rather than go to the cloud. It's just me. Maybe it's more than just me, but I just prefer local control instead of...
Hank, local control means your data is under your control.
Complete control.
Cloud data is open to the public. Anybody who wants it bad enough can get it.
Well, one of the things someone said to me is, well, with cloud printing, I don't have to worry about anything. And I said to her, do you know what their protocol is? And she says, what do you mean by that? I says, well, do you know how many versions they copy? Do they maintain a monthly copy for you? What's the retention cycle? What's involved in recovery? No, I haven't gotten to that yet, she said. And there is no set standard from company to company of what cloud computing is. That's a main issue.
In theory, if you're sending something to the cloud printer, Hank, there is no copy.
Well,
it just goes right to the printer.
Yeah. Hey,
but
Joe.
That's only theory.
Mm-hmm.
There might be hundreds of copies of everything you print, including your tax statements
balances. And of course, you know what your statement is. The NSA has access to it.
What's the NSA? Do you know what they used to say? The no such agency. The NSA was so secretive, you didn't even admit to it.
I tell you, with what has come out in the last 6 months by what the NSA has been doing and going to the FISA courts, and just automatically, was it 1,400 applications to the FISA court and only three was turned down? I mean, it's like a rubber stamp.
And the three were turned down because they had typos in them, I'll bet.
Yeah. Hey, you know, there was something that I thought was a typo, and I looked at it, and I was a little surprised by it. What happened was that I saw an article where Sharp said that, you know, Sharp Electronics, it went to court, okay, because what happened was that...
Well, what did they go to court for?
Well, they had licensed the use of the Sharp name, you know, the Sharp brand of TV to Hisense Electric, and Hisense Electric then been coming up with their TVs with a Sharp name on it, and Sharp says, no, do not buy Sharp brand TV names anymore because... all those are coming from Hisense, which they had a license. And the reason why Sharp is upset with it is because the quality of the Hisense brand TVs...
It wasn't a brand.
Well, the TVs they made is junk.
What they're really saying is the Sharp Aquis was one of the top TVs ever made. And when they stopped making TVs, and I'll ask Hank someday why they really stopped making them. There must be a story there. But they sold the name to this Chinese company, Hisense. And Hisense said, oh, with that name, we can make a lot of money. All we have to do is cut all the expensive stuff out of the TV, make it a junk TV, sell it under the Sharp name, and we'll make a big profit. Hank, what'd they do? Think they were Americans?
Now, wait a minute. Legally, they can they?
Absolutely. But there might have been one clause in the contract. I didn't get to read the contract, which said that Sharp had control over the quality, which would keep them from doing that. That Sharp said to them, hey, you're making junk, and they're saying, so sue us.
That's what Sharp did. They sued us.
Well, because I do know that other than Sharp, there are many manufacturers where they license the name to be used.
Also, are there any people who make TVs anymore other than the Chinese?
No, let's put it this way. There are no American TV manufacturers. What happened was that the last one was...
Well, Sharp was a Japanese anyway.
Well, the last TV maker was Sanyo. And what happened was that the Japanese had flooded the market with, undersold every American product that was TV. And what happened was that they were found guilty and they were fined $200,000. And I said that was a cheap way of getting into the market.
Absolutely. It spent that much on one week's
advertising. But Sanyo was the last manufacturer of TV in the United States, being made in the United States.
I can remember back far enough when Zenith was a name to be proud of.
RCA. Now, as you can see, RCA is the name RCA is put on a whole lot of products now. Not just TV, but, I was surprised. Another one is Polaroid, where their name's being used.
Well, Polaroid was sold at auction to the highest bidder, the name Polaroid.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we want to forewarn people is that what used to be a high-end name, check it out. That doesn't mean that it's a high-end product anymore.
No, absolutely not. Bell & Howell is another name that was to be proud of. Xerox. Kodak. Names are sold, names go into bankruptcy, names disappear. Don't go by reputation. It's a very sad story, but reputation is a good reputation for when that reputation was written about it. I hate to be this cynical about it, but I really have become very cynical.
Well, there's another thing that that was announced, not announced, I think. Basically, Intel made a statement, and I think people should be aware of it. Microsoft has been working out a deal with Qualcomm, and Qualcomm has come up with a Snapdragon a CPU at a very low cost, and they are able to do it where they also require very low voltage, so therefore the, you're using it in battery mode is very long, and Intel's doing catch up on that. And what Microsoft is saying, hey, you know what? We can come up with these low-cost TVs, and you're going to use the ARM chip. The ARM chip is the reduced instruction set. It's not the complex instruction set as the x86 chip. So Intel's looking at this and saying...
Well, wait a minute. Intel didn't really start looking at this until some person... I'm using the name person rather than getting into trouble. Some person said, it's no problem because we'll emulate the x86.
Well, what it is that Microsoft says, you know what? We're going to make a Windows on it. And they didn't use the word emulate. And then finally, in the past couple of weeks, instead of rewriting the Windows operating system to use the chip, they're going to run it on an emulator. And that's where the trouble started, okay? By using the word emulator, Intel saying, wait a minute, we didn't license you to emulate at all the x86 chip.
And under the copyrights and patent laws, emulation does not have to be a legal thing. You have to be very careful to get the right licenses all lined up. And they spoke a little bit out of turn, a little bit too soon.
Well, the thing is... Microsoft slipped, and what happened is now Intel is on the alert, and they put on notice not only Microsoft and Qualcomm, but they put on notice HP, Lenovo, Asus, and any other OEM manufacturer if you're going to put Windows on it. And say, if you put Windows on it and we see that emulation, we're going to come after you. Now, one of the things that you told me, Joe, is that any kind of a copyright infringement and so on, it all comes down to money. I think in this case, it's not going to come down to money. I don't think Intel's going to budge at all about any money at all. Because if the Qualcomm chip starts invading the low end and they can start developing, once you get a foothold, it's easy to build up, okay, in terms of scaling the more powerful CPU by having multi-core and so on. And Intel's not going to let it happen.
I don't know that. I'm never going to say never. It's still a matter of money. Does Intel make out better by not licensing, or does something happen that makes them better off by licensing?
Well, you know, Intel is a very smart company, and they handle the AMD challenge, the Ryzen chip. They met that challenge, or they're meeting it. Intel is a very successful company because they got not only smart engineers, but they got good businessmen. Did you know at one time that back in, early 1982, 83, that IBM owned 35% of Intel? And IBM says, we're not going to get into the commodity business. And they said to Intel, we're going to divest of you. And so basically, over a period of time, Intel bought all the stock back.
It's not an unusual thing that a company gets involved in something that's not their core business, and even though it might years from now become important, they sell out. Microsoft, in essence, was responsible for other companies being able to get into the operating system business.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Joe, did you know that a couple of weeks ago that Amazon and what's that big company that starts with an A? Walmart, okay? That's not an A. That's what with W.
I know. Wrong end of the alphabet. Yeah, was the Chinese alphabet.
Yeah. Well, Amazon and Walmart are having a, in a sense, a price war with shipping, okay? And Amazon's, of course, is offering the Prime shipping, and Walmart is saying, well, you know what, we can do it, and so on and so on. And it's becoming a really price war on shipping, and Amazon now has responded by saying they're going to drop the price on Prime. It's interesting. Have you read that bit about the Prime? But it's not really a drop. It's sort of like, well, you're not going to use it as much, so we're going to drop the price on it.
The problem there is that Prime offers came out originally just to give you a discount on shipping because you were the Prime customer, and you could get 2-day shipping free, and that was terrific. But Prime now is so many more things.
Yes, storage too.
You can get free movies. You can read free books. You can listen to free music if you're a Prime member. But I'll tell you what's more significant is the change that Amazon just made in their cloud storage. As a Prime member, I automatically got a significant amount of storage, and that has not changed. But they had offered me before this that if I paid $60 a year, not a lot. Actually, I think it was $59.95.
Unlimited you had.
It was unlimited storage. Now, unlimited not in the sense that Verizon uses the word unlimited. Unlimited in the sense that the dictionary says unlimited means without any limit whatsoever. Forget about it. You need storage. Here it is. You can have it forever. Well, if you still have that contract, they'll honor it for the rest of this year.
Amazon giveth and Amazon taketh.
After that, if you want unlimited storage, it's not available, but they will give you 1 terabyte of storage for what used to be an annual fee that was unlimited.
Well, 1 terabyte is quite a lot.
It's more than I would use, but if you wanted to get 32 terabytes, which is the maximum they would sell you now, it would cost you $1,800 a year. They've realized, and I think that they analyzed their customers and found that 99% of them didn't use more than 1 terabyte. So they said, well, screw the other 1%.
Well,
it's a good change. Normally, the 1% is screwing us.
Yeah, well, let me put it this way. Amazon is one of the biggies, and it seems like they're an elephant that they can set certain ground rules and everyone has to build around them.
At the time that Amazon had put in that unlimited storage, Hank, there were very few cloud storage places that were talking significant numbers. We had matter of gigabytes at other cloud storage places. So this was a ridiculously huge amount. Dropbox, Google Drive, other ones I can't think of, all offered free a reasonable amount of storage. Even Microsoft did.
Yeah. By the way, anyone who uses cloud storage, I want to tell you that you have to, in the back of your head, come up with an exit strategy, because if they come, if any of the cloud storage vendors say you can have this or at this cost, whatever it is, and all of a sudden the rates are changed dramatically, that you find that you can't, you know, it's unacceptable, you better have an exit strategy available, because you got a lot of stuff out there.
The best example I can think of was Kodak.
Oh yeah, with that Kodak gallery with all those pictures. And when they closed up, they gave everyone a very short notice.
I think it was 30 days. I'm not sure about that.
I think it was either 30 or 60 days, something like that. But it was really very short notice.
That was interesting, because that was unlimited storage. Any picture that was a Kodak picture was stored. And right now on Google, I have an interesting situation for you. Google has changed their storage requirements and their picture requirements, but if you take your picture with a Google camera like the Pixel, it is automatically stored when you take it, and it's unlimited storage.
For now.
They say as long as there's a Google, you'll have the storage. But they're talking about just for their pictures taken with their camera.
For now. I can give you the word for now, because they can change the rules, okay? They can.
No, they can't.
I have a bridge to sell you, Joe.
I have all my money tied up with the Tooth Fairy.
Hey, you know, one of the things that people were talking about is that there's a machine called Horizon, and it was something that was built and designed by Apple to fix and repair the phones. And
the screens on the phone.
The screens on the phone. And it's called Horizon. And it turns out that they are making this available for third-party screen repairs.
Up till now, you could have your smashed-up iPhone repaired at a reasonable price.
But it took time, though. You had to send
at a reasonable
back.
Price by people in the neighborhood who were undercutting the Apple price by half and two-thirds. There was only one small problem with it. By using them, you were violating your warranty, and nothing else was guaranteed or warranted. Then Apple signed up with a couple of third parties, and it was still very limited and very expensive to fix the screen on your phone. This is going to change everything. By that I mean Apple is going to recognize that if you don't provide a reasonable price, your customers are going to go away.
By the way, you were telling me that you were walking on the avenue and you saw one of these ads on one of these I call it the Link NYC monolith, but I call it Google monolith.
You're the only one who calls it a Google monolith.
It is because Link NYC is Google.
it's owned by Google, but this was on a thing that was called Link NYC. And they have in their tower there, they have the ability to change the color picture or the color billboard every few seconds. And they have advertisements for airlines and whatnot. And suddenly an advertisement came up on there that said you could repair your iPhone by taking it into a Federal Express at a given address. Now, I don't know if that was... They could only take it into that Federal Express at that address, and I don't recall the address, or you could take it into any Federal Express. I was curious about it, so before I came over to the show tonight, I looked it up on Google. Where else would I look it up? And I couldn't find it.
You couldn't find it? But you saw it at the storefront.
No, not the storefront. It's an obelisk.
Oh, okay. Did you put down Link NYC in your search?
I did.
And you didn't find it.
I found all sorts of other things. No, actually, I didn't put down. What I did a search was on iPhone repair.
Link NYC. That's what I would put in.
iPhone repair and Federal Express.
I would have put it in.
And I got thousands of hits because, unbeknownst to me, in order to get your iPhone repaired by Apple, they sent you a label on Federal Express to use.
Oh. Now, the reason why I said that, Joe, is because if you had said Link NYC, then it, whatever appeared on that monolith, you would probably be able to see it again. When you go home, you're going to try it, right?
Also, so is all the folks out there who have iPhones with cracked screens. They'll try it also.
Hey, Joe, one of the biggest complaints about the is with Apple is that, you know, they have to control everything. And if you want to add memory or if you want to, you know, make any changes to your iMac. And now the new iMac, they find out that the RAM and the processor is upgradable and replaceable by the user. That's the good news. Of course, Joe, what is the bad news?
Well, the way or the location of the slots is hidden a little bit.
Yeah, no, but that's not as bad as what the real bad news is. Which is, you void your warranty.
Oh, well, Apple has always done that.
Yeah. But go ahead, explain about the slot.
Incidentally, you're only voiding the warranty if you're doing it more than a year after you bought the machine, because the warranty is only a year good anyway. But this is a case of your having to remove the screen on the monitor in the way you did on the old IBM X41 all-in-one computer. And by removing it, the slots are open to you. But here's some more bad news. You need special tools to open it up. The news article that Hank and I read said, rip off the screen. Well, of course, you're not going to rip it off.
I think that was sort of like using the word rip is you don't rip off a screen, okay?
But on the other hand, to remove the screen, just as it was on the IBM.
You do it with care. You have to do it with care.
You need special tools. Now, they're not just tools from Apple or IBM. They're tools that people into repairing electronics would have available to them. But as far as the home user, it's like I wanted to replace the battery on one of the old iPods, very old one. And I saw how to do it, and I went onto YouTube and found a film on how to do it, but I couldn't figure out how to do it, remove the battery, remove the case without damaging it. So I did a little research on that, and for $100, I could buy a toolkit. Or by $100, I could have Apple do it for me. They got you coming and going.
Well,
I guess. How about the old-fashioned way of screwing it together so you can unscrew it?
I think that what Apple is evolving into, or at least that what they want to, is that there's a big piece of business out there. It's called service. And I think that they want to be able to be in the service business because when you consider all the iPads and iPhones and tablets and so on, with all the third-party people out there, it's a big business in repair.
It is, but I don't think Apple wants to get into the general service. They want to service Apple products.
Yeah. I mean, Apple products, because Apple has one advantage over all these third-party repair people is they have access at very low cost to spare parts.
They have that, but they also have a very limited number of items. If you take the whole world of technology, there are thousands and thousands of items. If you take the whole world of Apple technology, you've got a couple of different Macs, a couple of different iPhones, a couple of different this. It's very reasonable. They could set up a whole shop with just, half a dozen tools, and they're all set.
You know, one of the things that I was going to comment on is that with Apple, on the iPhones, you have all these colors, and they could easily say, we can repair it, but we can only do it in certain colors. And it's going to be black or white, and that's it. And
Henry Ford had no trouble selling cars. He said, I'll sell you a car in any color you want as long as it's black.
You know, that's one of the complaints that with many of the Apple followers is that why do they have such a wide variety of colors? Why not just keep it simple?
Well, actually, after they came out with all their colors, I'm told that the huge majority, the lion's share of sales were in the, still in white. And
piano white.
Piano white, white. And they also found there was an interest in a black phone, but very few red, pink.
And guess what? They got to stock up on that, and that's like sort of like, uh-huh, you got caught. You got to stock up on it.
Steve Jobs never would have done it.
Now, wait a minute. Just because Steve Wozniak said that Steve Jobs wouldn't have done it doesn't mean that Tim Cook doesn't have the smarts to you know, to do it, right?
I agree with Woz.
You agree with Woz?
I agree with Woz.
By the way, you know what? We're hitting the half-hour mark, and we do have a couple of very interesting segments that we want to get to, and let's get to it. Tonight, we are featuring three topics of interest. The first one, from Dr. Alfred Paul, is on wearable and health technology. He's going to be talking about Stanford University's study on fitness devices and how you walk and what it tells about you. And he's going to be talking also about smart tattoos. I will be doing a segment on digital cameras, and I asked the question, when is a digital camera not a digital camera? Well, I'll give you the answer now, but I go into greater depth. When a video recording time is maxed out at 29 minutes and 59 seconds. How do you get around it? I'll get to that. And on home automation with Marty Winston, I asked him a question. You know, with all the video contents we see, and you're trying to build a house that can look into the future, how do you know what to prepare for? So he's going to talk about future-proofing and content watching on the screen. Let's get to it right away.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. This week, I've got three really different stories, one about fitness bands, another one about how you walk and what that says about you, and a third one about tattoos. Not temporary tattoos, but real tattoos and whether they can be smart. To get started, I want to talk about fitness bands. And there's always been a whole lot of question about just how accurate these things are. A lot of people will wear two or three or more devices at a time to see how accurate their step count is. And you can find that they really vary quite a bit, but a lot of the good ones now are getting more accurate as far as step count goes. But what about the medical kinds of things that we are caring about now that we're looking to these devices to help us make decisions about lifestyle and exercise and our diet and so forth? And so a group of researchers at Stanford University School of Medicine decided to take a look. They took a bunch of seven popular devices, the Apple Watch, the Basis Peak, the Fitbit Surge, the Microsoft Band, the Mio Alpha 2, the Pulse On, and the Samsung Gear S2. And they ran them against a bunch of tests using clinical quality devices to measure data at the same time, and then they compared the results between the two. Two things they looked at were heart rate and the calorie consumption, how much energy the wearer used while the band was being worn. The results were quite interesting. The big story is on the heartbeat side was that essentially all of the devices, with one exception, were pretty accurate on heart rate. They were within 5% of the same results that were produced by the clinical equipment. On the other hand, they were not so successful when it came to estimating how much energy you consumed. In fact, none of the devices were within 20% of what the clinical devices registered. That means it could be at least 20% higher or lower, and in some cases, probably a lot more than that. You know, if you're looking at your diet and if your target's 2,000 calories a day in terms of exercise, the device may tell you that's 2,400, or it may tell you it's only 1,600 calories expended. That's a big, big difference. Since it takes 3,500 calories to add or lose a pound, being off by 400 or 500 calories per day could make a significant difference in what you're doing and what kind of outcome you get. The bottom line here is that these devices are pretty good where you're sensing information directly. The devices use different methods of measuring heartbeat, but most of them are pretty reliable. And so it's looking at changes in the blood vessels or electrical conductivity or some direct measurement that's a result of the heartbeat. However, it's when you get to things like the calorie burn, where they have to infer things based on the heart rate and maybe how much motion you've gone through, what steps you've taken. That's where they have to infer a fair amount, and they rely a lot on calculations to come up with an answer. And it's those kinds of things at this point where they're very weak. The information's not all that reliable. So heart rate, good. Step rate, probably pretty good. Advanced kinds of analysis like calories consumed, probably not very dependable. If you've been listening to these segments or if you've been reading on healthtechinsider.com, you know that one of the areas that I'm very interested in is energy harvesting. This is a way of taking energy from your environment and converting it into electricity or some other form that can then be used to power wearable electronics so that they don't need to be recharged as often or maybe recharged at all. We cover a lot of stories that talk about that kind of technology. Well, there's a new story coming out of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization in Australia. And what they've done is they've created a wearable device that will harvest energy as you walk. That motion that you take as you're walking, it can convert that into electricity to power wearable devices. You can charge a battery that you can use to run your different wearables. And that's nice and interesting, and it's also something that a lot of other people have been working on. What makes this story different, however, is that they've included the ability to analyze the energy as it's produced. So when you wear this device, say you have it clipped to your belt, as you take different steps, your natural gait, your natural motion, is going to create a pattern of electrical generation that's going to end up being unique to you. So they've actually figured that this could be a way to uniquely identify the wearer and could be used for security purposes. It could be used to identify you for different devices and services so you don't have to rely on passwords or fingerprints or other biometric kind of identification. Your identity can be verified simply by your walking style, which is kind of cool. They've tested this device and found that it was able to correctly authenticate an individual 95% of the time. It also uses a lot less energy, 78% less energy, than some of the other identification methods like fingerprint scanning on a smartphone. So it's an interesting development. Maybe we'll see it in the future, but it could be a technology that would help us make our wearables last longer and also identify ourselves securely for online services. My third story is about tattoos, smart tattoos in particular. Now, we've written a lot and talked a lot about temporary tattoos used as wearables. And these are little patches that can be stuck on the skin. And when they call them temporary tattoos, because it's like the things that kids often wear, they're very thin, they're removable, and they can be used with sensors, they can be used to control wearable devices. There's a whole lot of cool stuff that's going on with thin films that you would apply to your skin that then perform a bunch of different functions. But that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about tattoos. I'm talking about injecting ink below your skin. A group at MIT's Media Labs, they have a project called Dermal Abyss, and they're looking into ways to attach biosensors directly to skin. And what they've done is they've actually come up with different inks that will change color depending on the chemicals present in the fluid between the cells below the skin. So far, they've developed four different smart inks that can be used this way. One is for sensing glucose, the blood sugar levels in your body. It changes color based on the blood sugar level in your system. They've got another one that detects sodium levels, how much salt you have in your system. And then they have two more that measure pH value, the acidity. One simply turns from one color to another at a certain point. Another one changes over several different colors based on the acidity or base level in your system. But the point is that these are smart inks. They don't require any power. Just by looking at the colors of the tattoo in your skin, you could determine the different levels of these biometric measures. This is a little scary stuff, but the news is that this is not a real project at this point. It's basically just exploring the concept and trying to figure out what's possible. They haven't done any tests with live tissues, either on animals or people. There's no plans at this point to pursue clinical trials or to develop this into a real product. But it does point a little bit towards the future and indicate what we may be able to expect as our wearables become more than just something that we would stick to our body or strap on and actually become something that we would insert into our body to make our bodies smarter. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. A digital camera captures a still picture as a frame. Then it was possible to capture a stream of digital frames, which, when strung together, became a video clip. Technology did not just stop at a video clip. It is now possible to extend this data stream into minutes to enable the digital still camera to function as a movie camera. Now, this is where politics come in to define what is a camera. In Europe, many countries have import taxes on some gear, and in some places, the import tax on a still camera was zero, but the import tax on a camcorder could be 14%, and in some places, even more. So once still cameras got video, the European Union decided to define what is a still camera and what is a camcorder or a video camera. They set that line based on maximum recording time of 29 minutes and 59 seconds or less, and you're a still camera. But anything 30 minutes or more, you're a video camera, and you have to pay the import tax. So the limit we have here in the United States and elsewhere in the world is due to European camcorder import taxes. There are no special taxes in the United States on camcorders. To be price competitive, the digital camera manufacturers produce and sold units with a cap of 29 minutes and 59 seconds recording time. Technology marches on. Speed of frame capture and very high image resolution have enabled the use of digital cameras to make studio quality videos. Movie studios have been transitioning to using digital cameras as camcorders. Now, 29 minutes and 59 seconds have become a barrier. Can you imagine you're recording a wedding and you tell the minister pause so you can stop and then restart the camera because there is a recording gap? No, that's not going to happen. So where does this leave the digital camera manufacturers? Panasonic, as a good corporate citizen, enabled their GH series to record over 30 minutes by paying the tax and passing on the cost to the consumer, so there is no recording time limit on the GH4, the GH4R, and the GH5 models. But of course, you're paying the extra for this feature. So I guess that seems only right, or is it? Well, on computers, it's called BIOS or setup, and this is where parameters are set up. On a digital camera, it's called firmware. Now, Olympus and Canon all have this 29 minute and 59 second limit, and however, Sony and Nikon has done a little differently. They've abided by the European ruling by setting the limit onto firmware, however, that can be reprogrammed or otherwise unlocked. Now, of course, they don't do it, and if you do a quick search on YouTube, you will find that there are many videos available to show you how to change the parameters on the firmware. Well, will Canon Olympus follow suit? Yeah, they will, but when? Hopefully soon. If and when, and this is going to eventually happen, smartphones are unlocked on maximum video recording time, the smartphone is then really a smart video camera, and you are using a camcorder to make telephone calls. The telephone is a computer. Let's not forget that. But don't let the European Union know that, because with such a unit, you can walk and talk and compute all at the same time. Oh, wait a minute. I have to use the word chew gum. And they may realize they can cap your telephone call at 29 minutes and 59 seconds. You ain't gonna let that happen. Presenting Marty Winston on Home Automation.
A lot of people are asking me, a lot of people, Hank and others, about future-proofing our 40-year house project. 40yearhouse.com talks about the project. And I want to say this about future-proofing. Good luck with that. Let's take the example, and it's where I want to bring you this week, of the content you watch on a screen, be it a TV screen, handheld screen, tablet screen, your wristwatch. I don't know. The content you want to watch comes from content providers. Call it TV shows, call it content. it's pretty easy to anticipate that there's nothing stable about who will provide it or how. Let's go way back. It used to be you had to go to the content. There'd be an Odeon that would play the movie that you would watch. Later it was a Cinematheque, but it was a theater. You know, you'd go there and watch a movie that had to be played on a projector. There was only one movie in the neighborhood, and one film, and only a few places that could project it, and you went to it. And then it got home after, was 1948, with television. And television was delivered wirelessly over the air to an antenna, and you would connect an antenna. You can still connect an antenna and pick up not only local stations, but the multicasts on local stations. You think you have three stations, you may have six or seven or eight or more. You think you have five stations, you could have a lot more. Multicasts over the air, still a way to get content, and you don't pay for it except to the extent that you have to watch commercials, endure those to watch your shows. So, you know, that's been there. And then there were communities where they didn't have a station. So they got together and built what were called community antenna television systems, CATV. And they would have a big tower with lots of very high-gain antennas on it, and they would bring in stations from as far as they could reach, and it would go through amplifiers, and they had a way to distribute it to homes over a cable. Yeah, this was where cable TV came from those community antenna TV stations. Came down the cable into the home. And they were common enough, they were out there enough, that people with other content to sell, premium content to sell, approached them and said, we'll find a way to deliver our content to you if you're willing to sell it to your subscribers. Because they were already collecting a fee. Now here's a way to layer in more fees. And that's really how cable TV became a more mercenary kind of venue. And as cable TV spread, even in metropolitan areas where antennas were doing just fine at getting signal, more and more channels developed. A lot of money nationwide was getting spent at watching that content. So, you know, in the house, you had a cable connection, you had the antenna. That was the start of having choices. And then there was this decision to launch satellites that could send TV directly to a dish on the roof at home. And satellite contended for the source of that content. And then there were major phone companies like Verizon and AT&T that decided, well, let's go higher bandwidth and let's run fiber to the home. So today, you know, obviously you can have fiber to the house, you can have cable to the house, you can put an antenna up, you can have a dish for satellite. And whether or not you're getting TV content directly, those give you, in many cases, high bandwidth, most of them, the internet connections, well, two out of the four do. And those high bandwidth internet connections are another way of deriving content through Roku, through Hulu, through smart TV sets, all of that stuff. What's it going to be tomorrow? Will it be wired? Will it be wireless? Will it come in a route that we recognize? I dare you to future-proof your house for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 40 years against changes in how that content will be delivered. There is one thing that you may be able to do. It's the one thing that we're doing. And that is to provide places to wire to where the content needs to be. And to provide places where we can install and update wireless for the devices that will take wireless. So if tomorrow or 10, 20, 40 years from now, you need a direct IP connection, that's the only way to get content, or you have a Wi-Fi IP connection or whatever, we want to be able to wire to it whether or not we have precisely the kind of wire it's going to need already installed. In an ultra-automated house, we want content access to be source agnostic. But what, you know, does that really mean? It means whatever it is, you can get it to the set. That's really all it means. Will TV sets be involved or just our mobile screens? You know, there's just as much hassle wiring for wireless as there is wiring for wire, and even more if you're wiring for fiber. How do you future-proof that? Well, the bottom line is, you can't. But you can make your home more adaptive to it. I might add, almost every case of content distribution is going to involve power, either directly to the thing where you're viewing the content, or indirectly through a charger. So, well, Hank will always remind you to back up, back up, back up. I will add to that, surge protect. Don't let it fry. If there's going to be an explosive adventure, let it be in what you're watching. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. We are preparing a special broadcast on July 12th, and we will be presenting a show on the convergence of health and technology. 60 years ago on that date, July 12th, 1957, U.S. Surgeon General Leroy Birney connected smoking with lung cancer. This is a very serious issue in the United States. 480,000 deaths per year in the United States, including more than 41,000 deaths resulting from secondhand smoke exposure. We'll have Dr. Alfred Poor and Dan Rosenbaum, who is the editor and publisher of Health Insider, to discuss this very important issue. Public service announcements. The following are regional computer club meeting announcements, and you should check very carefully if you happen to be a regular computer club attendee. Many of them have changed their schedule slightly for the month of July because July 4th falls on a meeting date. And there are some clubs that are not meeting during the summer, so please check their website. But for what we have, the Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, June the 27th, in the community room of the Princeton Public Library in Princeton, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be having a presentation on Tune Up Your Windows PC, held on a Thursday, June the 29th, starting at 6:45 p.m. in the Middletown Library Large Computer Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society is having a presentation on using the iPad with a person living with dementia. The presentation is on Tuesday, July 11th, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, July 11th at 7:15 p.m. in the Rasa Room on the fourth floor at the Palisades Moore in West Nyack. The general meeting of the New York Amateur Computer Club will be held Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. at NYU at the Silver Building, Room 411, located on 31 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. So how do you check whether there's a meeting or not? Go to pcradioshow.org. On the left-hand side, we have a section called Announcements. And you click on that, it'll take you to the websites of the regional computer clubs. And many of them hope to see you there, even though it's the summer and the places they have chosen are air-conditioned. These meetings are all open to the public free of charge, and they hope to see you there one day. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, and of course, back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.